From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in relational Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Beth Korth, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy. I, too, make nice games. In this episode, we talk with Ron Gilbert, founder of Terrible Toy Box, and a creator and writer on many famed series, including Monkey Island, Pajama Sam, Maniac Mansion, and Thimbleweed Park, to discuss the intersection of puzzle and story. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start. Okay, before we get into it, Beth is here. Yep. Beth is a guest host for today. Beth is a narrative designer who's been on the show a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. And so Beth is a particularly good guest host for this episode because that's what we're going to be talking about. But not just story, narrative design, right?
Yeah.
So many things to talk about with our guest. Ron Gilbert, welcome to Nice Games Club. Welcome to the clubhouse.
Thanks for having me.
We have a thesis on this show that everything is everything. So I want to hear your thoughts on the connection between those two things.
Yeah, I think those two things are completely interwoven, right? I don't think you could really have one without the other, right? If you have just a narrative and the puzzles are just disconnected puzzles you do, they don't really help the narrative. And so it's why are they even there, right? Everything should help the narrative. The narrative should help inform the puzzles, and the puzzles should help drive the narrative. We often use, like in adventure games, the puzzles, I don't mean this in a bad way, but they're a way to slow the player down, right? Because if you had no puzzles, you would be done with Monkey Island in a half hour, right? And so the puzzles are kind of a way to slow the player down, but in a good way, right? Just by giving them this really fun activity that they're going to go do. But, you know, I've always had this philosophy that puzzles in the game, they should inform the player about the world. They should inform the player about the main character, or they should inform the player about the story, right? If the puzzle does not do one of those three things, it's a pointless puzzle and it should be removed. Mm-hmm. So as long as the puzzles do one of those three things, then it's a good puzzle. And I think to players, it'll feel like a natural puzzle. It won't feel like this thing that was just thrown in at them, but they will really feel like, oh, well, I need to do this because it's helping me. The story wants it, or I'm going to learn something through it. I think that's key to doing adventure games. Probably true other games, and I haven't done narrative games that aren't adventure games. So there probably are some different rules for a game that's not an adventure game, but those are my rules for adventure games.
Yeah. I really like that framing of it. It's like that puzzles are a very useful, like, pacing tools for the narrative. It's something I hadn't really considered, but it totally makes sense in retrospect, because it definitely gives the player permission to, like, take their time here and really analyze what's going on in the game in the moment, because, like, I guess you're kind of forcing the player to, like, do that in order to get through this puzzle. But I think that, like, I think it helps the player, like, get into that mindset where they can feel comfortable slowing themselves down, because like, I think especially, you know, nowadays, like, people are really trying to get through content as quick as possible, so I think that, like, having puzzles like that are really valuable.
Sadly, that is true. It's like people burn through content, and it's particularly frustrating, and it always has been with adventure games, where people would sit down and play your game with the hint guide, you know, and we're really just reading the walkthrough or reading the hint guide to get through the game. And I'm always like, well, why are you bothering? Why are you doing this? Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, you know, still do this. And that was a big struggle for us. And, you know, with Thimbleweed Park and also Return to Monkey Island, you know, we had a hint system that was built into the game, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in both cases, the hint system was really a part of the world. It was a part of the narrative. You know, right. In Thimbleweed Park, the 1-800 line, you actually had to go to a phone and call. And in Return to Monkey Island, it was a magical book that that you got from the voodoo person. And I like that, because if people are going to just use a hint guide, which a lot of people will. At least they're kept in our game fantasy, right? They're not opening a browser window. And even if they're not, even if they're using the hint guide, they're still in our world because, you know, the hint guide is very much a part of the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I have a little sympathy for people who do follow along, even though I'm very much the everything should be everything holistic kind of person.
Sure.
Like as a designer, I have some sympathy for someone who just says like, I just want the story.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think they recognize that they're only getting like less than half of the experience when they do that. But I do have a little sympathy for people who just want to like experience some of what's available because they don't feel that they're able to get their hands around the whole thing.
Yeah.
And so I think your solution by bringing that stuff into the gameplay, I would like to think, and you might have playtest data on this, that probably helps those people who are quicker to look outside. Do you think those people who do sort of go off the path and do it the wrong way, quote unquote, do you worry about those people or do you just let them have what they can get?
Well, I mean, it's their money, right? They bought the game.
That's true.
And it's, well, I don't really care what they do with it, sure. Right? Mm-hmm. So I would prefer that they kind of enjoyed it the way that I intended to be enjoyed. But if for some bizarre reason, you know, they want to do something else with the game, then that's fine. It's their game at that point.
Yeah.
But I just want to make sure that I'm not doing something in the game that is making them go do the
interviews,
right? The puzzles are too stupid or too hard or too weird that they now have to use the hint guide. It should be an option for people. You know, I think the other thing that we kind of battle is games are too long these days, right?
You're here.
I think when Monkey Island came out and, you know, you were 8 years old, spending 40 hours on the game was probably fine. But especially looking at something like Return to Monkey Island, where, you know, we're pulling in this whole audience that may have enjoyed the games when they were younger, but they're older now and they're married and they have kids and they don't have 40 hours to spend on a game. So, you know, you want to be able to let them kind of enjoy it in a span that works for them. I don't have 40 hours to watch a movie, you know. And if I have a couple hours to watch a movie, and that's it. And I think I, at some level, I would be happier if no game was longer than 2 hours, right? That was kind of the limit of the games, because then I could do something a lot more kind of intense and focused in a few hours of a game. But that's just kind of not the world we live in.
Right. I do want to go back to something you said earlier about puzzles being that sort of pacing element.
Yeah.
And also you asked, like, you don't know if that's like that in other genres. So Beth, I want to bring you in because as a narrative designer, because you've not worked on puzzle adventure games.
No.
But you've worked on games with a lot of story.
Yeah.
So does that ring true as like a pacing? Is there something equivalent in other genres or are things really different?
Oh, I've been thinking a lot through this whole conversation because it's like, if the puzzles don't support blah, 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 you know, like this, they don't hit the pillars. And I was thinking about like how I've done that in like Verdant Skies and stuff like that. And we struggled a lot with our hint system, which ended up being mail, which was then like a quest log tracker thing. Mm. And I think that the pacing is a little bit different because it is puzzles, but not. So like it's collections, right? Yeah. So like the way that you integrate those into the game, I think, is similar. So like when we had characters to unlock, there were definitely some that I would probably rework because I've heard feedback in the years since that, you know, like it took too long to unlock that character. I never got to meet them. Mm-hmm. Oh. And stuff like that. Which is the benefit of more playtesting. But yeah, I think it's similar because it's not puzzles, but there's collections or there's side quests or et cetera.
Yeah, yeah. And there's always going to be the chance that it doesn't...
Don't do it. You don't need that character to finish the game.
Yeah.
The game I'm working on right now is more of an RPG than it is an adventure game. But there is a lot of narrative, right? It's kind of a narrative RPG. But, you know, there are quests you do, but they're not puzzles necessarily.
Sure.
They're puzzles in that to do the quests, there's, you know, a fair amount of combat you have to do. Mm-hmm. And I think the combat kind of becomes the puzzle friction in some ways in this game. And then you have, well, do I have the right weapons? Have I, you know, got the right gear, et cetera? And so I think that the combat kind of takes the place of the, you know, the logic puzzle solving in this game.
Sure. But I mean, even in that same vein, right, it's still important that whatever tool you're using for as a pacing tool still fits within the world.
Right.
I think that, like, I mean, y'all both have established that to me as somebody who hasn't really worked on a narrative game from a designer point of view. That definitely rings true to me, is that, like, it's imperative that, like, it all still fits, because, like, this is why people are playing the game.
Yeah, there's what it is, and then there's what it does.
Yes.
Right? And I suppose there has to be tons of benefit from having as much experience as you have, learning what it does, so that what it is can be something different next time. Is that true, or do you stumble into each game?
Well, I think experience is a weird double-edged sword, mm-hmm. right? It's really nice to have a lot of experience. You know, I can look at a situation and kind of be able to assess it out very quickly. You know, 40 years of experience tells me don't do this, right?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I kind of feel, especially with Maniac Mansion, and I gave a whole talk on this with Maniac Mansion, I think that game was what it was because Gary and I were too stupid to know it couldn't be done, right? So we just did this thing. Mm. And I worry that as I become more experienced, I lose the ability to be too stupid to know that it can't be done.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of games that I see, and I'm like, wow, I wish I would have thought of that. And I know that had I thought of it, I would have rejected it because of all of these reasons or experience. So I do wish I had that ability to be too stupid. So I think that's the double-edged sword of experience.
You need to have like a confederacy of dunces that just follow you around.
Yeah.
To provide that for you.
Yeah, just not know that, you know, that this can't be done. I'm too easy. It's too quick for me to go, oh, we can't do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then somebody, you know, goes off who doesn't have the experience and does just that, mm-hmm. and the game is highly successful.
Yeah.
Like, I loved Vampire Survivors. I never would have made that game.
Yeah.
There's so much about that game where I would have went, oh, don't do that. Oh, don't do that. You can't do that. And I never would have made that game.
Yeah. I feel the area I have the most experience in is, like, visual graphic design from my previous career. And I feel exactly the same way about Among Us, which I think is the ugliest game ever made. And I would have put a stop to that so soon, but that's so part of its charm.
Yeah.
Right? So I in a different way, I totally feel what you're saying.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I do think that's one of the reasons, you know, as I get older and more experienced in business, I like to work with people who are not experienced, right? Mm, yeah. Because I want to work with people who will bring up the stupid ideas that can't be done. And I think that kind of balance, like, is super important. Like, if I just made games with my crusty old LucasArts friends, I think you'd have different games than if I made them with a team that was a lot more diverse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like that. I think there's a whole cohort of designers who made their first games when you did. And I think the most successful of them that are still working today have that approach that you have. I suppose that's been difficult, or is it really just a this makes sense, charge forward?
Yeah, I don't think it's so difficult. There's certainly been some cases where I have not liked a particular idea. I mean, who knows whether it was good or bad. But I think in general, you kind of have to trust the people that are around you.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't ever want to be the person that walks into the room and tells everybody, back in the old days, we would never have done that, so we're not going to do it now. But rather just let all these ideas kind of come through from a lot of different people.
Yeah,
that's cool.
that almost sounds a little bit like you're trying to recapture a little bit of that too stupid. It's like you're recognizing you don't know what people who are newer to the industry or people who are a little more greener, you don't have that perspective, and that's your version of too stupid, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, don't tell my teammates that I think they're too stupid.
I was going to say, he didn't say it that way, Mark, because it's like implying his team's dumb.
No. No, I don't mean that at all. I mean that you not imposing your experience is you electing to be too stupid. Is to say, like, I'm too dumb to check this thing from people. Like, I'm just going to trust that they know what they're doing, even though I have the experience. Gosh. Like, I think that's the... But, you know, take it how you like.
And I agree. It is that. I was just making a joke.
Yeah, so. For sure.
So I'm curious the how you even get started, like designing these puzzles or these stories and combining them together. Like, how do you even begin to think of a puzzle as part of the narrative, or how do you start to think of this story as it relates to this puzzle? Because that's definitely not something I have ever had to do, and I'm really curious how that process,
like, which comes first.
Oh yeah,
which,
I like
maybe
that.
Which comes first, or how?
Puzzle
how,
I or guess, the like, narrative.
How do you begin? Which comes first? I guess.
I think for me, you know, I always start with the world. Right, yeah. It's coming up with a world, and for Monkey Island, it was pirates. Right, I enjoyed the Pirates of the Caribbean ride. I wanted to live in the Pirates of the Caribbean ride. So for Timmy McGann was that world, right? That weird pirate world. For Maniac Mansion, you know, Gary and I were big fans of, you know, crappy B horror movies. And so we wanted to create a game that existed in that world, you know, the crappy B horror. And so I always start with the world. And then the world will start to bring out stories, you know, that, oh, well, we're going to go into the mansion to, you know, rescue our girlfriend, or we're, you know, going to defeat the pirate LeChuck. I mean, there's a story that kind of evolves out of the world. And then from that, as I lay out the world, I start to put kind of puzzles. And a lot of the puzzles, I know this is going to sound horrible, but a lot of the puzzles are there simply to slow down the player.
Yeah, right.
You know, I kind of realize, oh, well, they'll get through this too fast, so we need a bunch of puzzles. And then thinking about the puzzles, okay, well, this is an interesting puzzle, but how does it affect the story? How does it tell us more about the world or the main character? So, you know, I start with world and then location, or world, story, locations, and then kind of weave puzzles into that.
That puts it in perspective. I guess it does kind of feel like puzzles. The only word I could come up with right now is afterthought, and I know that's not what you were saying. But
well, you know what it is? That what that sounds to me like, mm-hmm. I think, because I'm guessing that's not where the process ends.
Yeah.
But what that sounds to me so far is like Professor Layton, where just random puzzles of no particular import along the way. Mm. I love that series. That's a totally different vibe.
Yeah.
But it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like it's that pacing element is the first step. And then, but when you put a puzzle in, does it start as a draft? Like, this is just a roadblock. We'll figure it out later how it ties in. Or once it goes in, does it have to start weaving in right away for it to make sense to you?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes, you know, someone will come up with a fun puzzle that's just, oh, that's fun. Mm-hmm. And then we'll figure out, well, how does that tie back into the world?
Okay.
What are the little pieces? And the puzzles are multi-layered, right? We may come up with the, you know, the end puzzle, you know, to get in somewhere or to disable the robots. It's like, okay, that's a puzzle. We need to disable the robots. But that's actually three or four puzzles before that. It takes three or four sub-puzzles to disable the robots. And so, you know, I tend to like work backwards. It's like I kind of start with the bigger picture puzzle, and then I work back at, you know, what are the sub puzzles that'll get me, you know, to that particular puzzle.
Okay, so it kind of sounds like the order to me then is like narrative informs the puzzles, but then the puzzles start informing bits and little details of the narrative. If I'm understanding it.
I mean, it's a round and around process, right? Yeah, it's you don't have the narrative and then come up with the puzzles, right?
Sure.
You have the narrative, you come up with the puzzles, you change the narrative, you change the puzzles, you change the narrative. All of those things just kind of feed on each other.
Yeah. Does each iteration of that loop, does that like eventually approach zero and then it's done? Or could it go on forever and you have to find a, just find a place to stop? And like it's working.
Yeah, I think we run out of time, you know?
Fair enough.
Yeah, that's...
I think it could go forever.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably go as, you know, as deep as you want, right? It's puzzles all the way down, yeah. Right? That's true. Yeah. At some point, you just stop, you know?
Yeah. Related to that is the sort of balance between those things in terms of like narrative depth, and then related to that, puzzle complexity, right? Mm. The sort of how hard do you go in each of them?
Oh, yeah.
I think one of the games of yours that I'm the biggest fan of is The Cave. And I think a lot of, there was a knock on that game that like, oh, it's not hard enough. And I remember thinking that that was one of its best features.
Right.
Because, and I don't know if that was your intention, but like, I liked that it was narrative focused and that the balance was on that side. Do you aim for a balance? Do you aim that this one's going to be more focused on the eureka moments that the player has, the solving the puzzles, the challenge, and then the story is going to be either compromised or it's going to service that, or the opposite, where it's like, this is going to be focused on the narrative, so we don't want the puzzles to take you off the course too much, or is it, I'm giving you a lot of options, or is it not a pulley between them, that they could both go hard or they could both be light?
Well, I think that you're giving me way too much credit. I think I just start doing shit until I'm done. Okay. Right. I don't really think about it as, oh, well, this is going to be a puzzle heavy game or this is going to be a narrative heavy game. I just kind of start doing stuff. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And at some point, it is what it is. And, you know, we do a lot of play testing in the game. And that's one of the reasons that we kind of say, okay, well, this puzzle's too hard, right? Mm-hmm. Like, playtesters may get stuck on a puzzle that we thought was really easy, but they're stuck on it, right? So we can solve that by simplifying the puzzle. Often we solve that by just kind of helping to inform the puzzle a little bit better, explaining the puzzle, you know, in the narrative, you explain the puzzle a little bit better, helping the player kind of get some hints about how they go. Sometimes it's adding a little sub puzzle that's a little bit easier to do, but it helps you then solve the greater puzzle. And that, you know, that's hard to guess at, right? And I think that's one of the reasons, or one of the things that my experience is good at, is I'm pretty good at looking at adventure game puzzles and going, oh, that's going to be a hard one. That's going to be an easy one.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, having people play the game is really the only way that you can do that.
Yeah, that's a real, I mean, you feel it out, right?
Yeah.
So then what are the roles of game design document or design pillars? How much does that inform that feel it out process? Do you find yourself like, oh, the game is going in this direction because it feels right? Maybe that's drifting away from what we thought, but we didn't care that much to begin with, so let's go with it.
Mm-hmm.
Or is there like steps along the way where you reconsider and maybe rewrite those documents or something? I mean, process is different for every team, but
yeah, in my career, I haven't really worked with a lot of publishers, right? I haven't mm-hmm. worked with outside people that need to approve something or also like it. I have been, you know, very blessed in my career to basically kind of do whatever the hell I want, you know, in the games. Yeah. And so I haven't really thought about that. You know, it's like, I don't really start with like pillars that need to be followed. I start with, well, here's a cool world, here's a cool story, and here are a bunch of cool puzzles that need to get put in. And it kind of goes where it goes.
Yeah.
Huh. I was reading a lot about like Stephen King when he writes stuff, right? He just writes. Mm-hmm. He doesn't necessarily have this goal that he's trying to do. He just kind of writes and lets the story go where the story needs to go. And I think that's kind of how I approach adventure games, is just letting it go where it needs to go.
Yeah.
Beth, if I may, you had said earlier that you used that you used design pillars to design your game. So it sounds like your experience was quite different. You want to speak to that some?
I mean, kind of. So I also do like the world first.
Okay.
So Andy had design pillars.
Okay.
In a drawer somewhere that you didn't look at.
No, I read them, I'm sure. I can't remember what they were because that was years ago. But I think like it starts with the world building and then the individual stories in the world. But like the pillars that we had, I think were like really easy ones. Like it's a game I would want to play, right? Sure. Like it's a farming life simulation, right? So like if it doesn't support those couple things, then you don't take it. I think it's interesting because like you'd said earlier, if the puzzle doesn't support, like doesn't inform on the character, if the puzzle doesn't inform about the world, then like it doesn't make it in, right? So there are pillars that you use, kind of, but I like that because I can tell when a game has been made without those like pillars established, like the puzzle goes in only if it informs on the character or informs the world, because those are the puzzles that people are like, I can't believe I have to hack another blah blah blah, like, right? Those are the things that people complain about. Those are the bad puzzles,
right?
So I think it's interesting. I skirted around your question.
I think you answered it. It sounds like there's a lot. You kind of like you don't necessarily establish like design pillars and that these are the four things that we got to hit that everything in the world has to match. It's more that you built out this world and so you understand how the world works, and that helps you build out the designs or stories that you're telling within this world.
Yeah, because you know, it's like you were saying, the puzzles come and the narrative comes and then you change one and then you change the other a little bit. I think that that's the important part of game development, is having a team that can speak the same like language, jargon, whatever, to understand.
And so design pillars are a tool in which you can do that. But like if you have another way to do that, then like more power to you.
It's all just checking against decisions you've already made.
Yeah. Basically,
right? Whatever you call it. And whether that's an organic process or a more rigid one. Sometimes it depends on team size.
Yeah, that's true too.
So every now and again, a Nice Games Club, we'll get like a big old guest.
Yeah.
Right? And that's happening this week, you might have noticed. Yeah, exactly right. That's kind of our attitude too. We're really want to talk about the things we want to talk about. And so whether, you know, whoever the guest is. But at the same time, sometimes that means that there'll be new listeners to the show who have not heard it before, who come for the guest rather than for us and our charming personalities or for our lovely guest hosts. I was being serious.
Sorry.
So welcome, new listeners. This is Nice Games Club. I hope you've enjoyed it so far. There's still a whole back half of the show for you.
Yes.
If you're a regular listener of the show, you might want to know like how the show can grow and get interesting guests and do more stuff. And Stephen, how is it that happens?
Well, you can go to our Patreon, patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
That's right. This isn't just a kumbaya moment. We are asking for your money.
Yes.
helps us. Please give it to us.
Yes, it helps us because running a show is expensive. And we kind of do a lot of this stuff out of our pockets.
Yeah, so if you're a longtime listener and you're like, hey, I've seen value in the show. I know it's a good thing.
Yeah.
Maybe now's the time to sort of like step up and help fund the thing. Mm-hmm. Now I'm acting like it would be a shame if your market burned down or something. That's not what I mean. But what benefit is there to the listener other than, say, making us, you know, stress a little bit less on how to fund the thing?
Yeah, well, you get access to extra content, additional Patreon exclusive content, ad-free episodes, because I'm sure you're listening. If you're listening to this and you've just shown up, you're hearing an ad after this.
Yeah, maybe even more than one.
Yeah.
That's how cruel we are to you. And if you're new to the show and you're like, I'm not ready to take that leap just yet.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe listen to some more episodes, see some other types of episodes that we do, and then consider it.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
You can check out all the additional content that we have that is available at patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
I feel like you got to get something in there about, like, we might be interviewing the renowned puzzle maker, but it's no puzzle about whether you should give us some money.
Wow.
But I, I couldn't come up with it while you were.
Are we still recording?
Are we?
Yeah, I'm putting that in there.
Wait.
So everyone can get a sense for like what we normally don't put into the show, and how much work it is to make it right.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it, Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over a million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Think of a song you really love.
Don't you want to know why you love it so much?
Well, we can't answer that.
No, but we can deep dive into it anyway.
Unless we get too sidetracked.
We're the Nevermind the Music podcast.
One musician.
And one psychologist.
Talking about iconic songs. The musical tricks that blow our minds.
And what they show us about our minds.
Join us each week as we pick apart everything from TLC to Weezer.
And from Billie Eilish to Bruno Mars, with plenty of distractions in between.
Check out Nevermind the Music, wherever you get your podcasts.
Something you said was interesting that relates to something that Ron said earlier, which was I have to hack a thing again.
Yeah.
But Ron, earlier you were saying, talking about like a sub puzzle on your way where you can like learn a process before you get to it.
Yeah.
And just doing the same, you know, puzzle to get through this door and that door and that door. That, I mean, action games do that, I guess, but yeah. Like that's not satisfying. But getting something that's like using the same kind of like mechanic or object or story point. So how do you approach that kind of evolving mechanics for a player, where someone dropped into the middle of a game would have a lot harder time solving a puzzle than someone who'd been playing from the beginning? Do you think a lot about that? And if so, how do you build those?
Good question.
Well, I don't think about mechanics as much, because adventure games, you know, they are a mechanic, right? There is a mechanic that you do, especially point and click adventure games. And I'm trying to work within the framework of that established mechanic for the games.
Yeah.
But what I am looking at, though, is the story, right? That you can't drop somebody in the middle of a game any more than you can drop them in the middle of a movie and expect them to understand what's going on.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of story that's leading up to the puzzles, and why am I doing this puzzle? What am I going to get from doing this puzzle? That you kind of inform through the building of the story of what's going on.
That sounds a lot like it's called the puzzle dependency graph.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, right.
Oh,
which when you really drill down to it is like, well, especially for adventure games, so much of the puzzle is I have the key. It's bronze. I know where the bronze door is.
Right.
And that's not a puzzle. That's story. Right, even though it's expressed that way, so that you're kind of describing story in a way that so that's it. It's the same thing, right?
Yeah. Although technically, not to nitpick your example here,
oh, please.
But you, technically, you should have found the bronze door before you have found the bronze key.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's tutorial design.
Yeah. You should always find the lock for the key.
Right, because then you give the player the opportunity to make that connection in their mind. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or if they found the key, it's greatly disguised that it's actually a key for the bronze door.
Yeah, yeah. So that, because so much of that gameplay happens in the player's head, like because that's what puzzle solving is, it's figuring it out.
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk about playtesting, because that's how you can test whether that's working or not. I think we're disciples of the Church of Playtesting here on Nice Games Club.
True.
But every now and again, I do think to myself, like, sometimes you can thought experiment your way.
Yeah.
And sometimes that will save you some time. So I want to hear your approach on it, because you said you do a lot of playtesting, but is a lot of it essentially to confirm things, or is it to test things, or is there a point where you just have faith in a notion? Who cares what these 30 people said? I'm going to throw it. Like, how do you approach that generally?
Yeah, I think what you said is probably accurate. I think a lot of the playtesting that we do is really to confirm things. You know, it is to make sure that this puzzle is hard it out for. If it's an easy puzzle, it's in the right place. We're wrong about that, and we adjust for those things.
Yeah.
But it's not like we have this big giant game. We have no idea whether this is going to be fun or not. Let's go with some playtesters figure that out.
Yeah.
So I think we have a pretty good idea that what we're doing is right, and that just comes from experience. And then the playtesting is to validate that, and also to test very specific things in the design that we might have questions about.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the real UX stuff, right? That informs the puzzling in the story.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
Do people notice the puffer fish sitting on the bench, right? It's like, that's kind of key, but we're not sure whether anyone actually notices it. So that's the kind of thing that playtesting is good for, is realizing nobody noticed it. You know, here it was sitting right there. We thought it was obvious, but nobody noticed it. That is very typical of the type of things that we get out of playtesting.
Yeah, yeah. And then what happens when you are wrong, what is the process? Do you feel in those cases you know enough to know what's right, or does it have to go back into the hopper one or two more times to check again?
Usually we kind of know what's right. But it's something we're always keeping an eye on,
yeah.
You know, in future playtests. If somebody didn't notice the wrench sitting on the table, and we've done something to make it more obvious, or have the narrative point out a little better, then we're kind of looking at that in other playtests. Like, did that work? You know, we might be pretty sure it worked, but did it work?
Right, right. And then, what's your tolerance for? Like, well, if we make this more obvious, it's going to start pulling another thread we don't want it to pull.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you have to decide on a compromise maybe to one thing or another. What's your sort of decision framework for those situations?
Yeah, I probably err on the side of making it harder for players, right? If I'm not going to make a bunch of decisions and make things easier, right? It is really easy, especially in playtests. It's really easy to look at something and go, oh, well, players didn't notice the wrench on the desk. Let's make the wrench jump up and down. Right? Let's make it sparkle. Let's show these things. But that's not always the right thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of the pleasure of adventure games is figuring things out, mm-hmm. right? And so as long as we're being fair about the wrench sitting on the table, we've given people the right clues about the wrench on the table, I don't necessarily want to start, pointing an arrow at the thing. Because that does kind of ruin why people are playing these games in the first place. Well, is to figure it out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, this is why this topic is important, because like that is a combination of the two. I realize that like puzzles are end up being like a pacing tool for a story, but a lot of people approach these adventure games in particular because they're interested in solving these really wild, interesting puzzles. They don't have the opportunity to solve the puzzle, or the game like doesn't present them with that opportunity because they made it, they signpointed everything so you don't miss things, then like effectively you're just going through the story. They're just reading a guide, which is not what, which is not what you want.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a cool thing to, I think that's important to point out, and I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, a lot, when you're doing playtests, it's very common for people who are watching the playtest, for them to go, oh, well, players didn't notice the wrench, so let's make it easy, right?
Mm-hmm.
The inclination is to take every problem a player found and solving it by making it easier.
Yeah.
And you really have to resist that. It's like sometimes you do want to do that because the puzzle is unfair. But a lot of times you just don't want to do that. Like, it's okay for people to take time. And, a design should have lots of spiky, pointy edges to it, right?
Yeah.
And you can pound your design away so it's a nice, smooth little ball, but it's uninteresting, right? It's all the spikes and the crevices that kind of make your design and your story interesting. So they shouldn't all be pounded away.
Yeah. Because then you're just making an app.
Then you're just making an app.
Right? Which is like, great. But that's difficult because a lot of the tools you use as a designer, as a team, for playtesting is very similar to the types of tools you use to like make this menu more obvious.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you have to remember you're an artist along the way, right? That you're making choices creatively for sure.
Yes. It shouldn't be a puzzle to find my account balance in my baking app. Right.
Right. Right. Right.
Although not a bad idea for a game.
For a game, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For a game, that's a really good puzzle, but not for my baking.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that'd be interesting.
Depends on how much is in your account, I suppose.
Oh, maybe.
How badly do you want to reach that number?
Oh, that's fun.
So you're talking about pacing, about like those roadblocks of like put a puzzle in to break up the story. But then you're also talking about these spiky points in the mechanical, the user story,
yeah,
of the difficulty. How do you pace out a hard puzzle, an easy puzzle? And then, of course, you have to weave in the story to that. So you have a rising action. Maybe you don't want to slow that one down as much, but you still want puzzles. Or maybe this is where the big important things need to happen. So you want the player to stop on a real challenging one. I'm sort of answering the question, but like that's that is so fascinating to me and must be enormously difficult because you don't always know what's easy and what's hard at the margins.
Yeah, because you've got the story flow going on, yep, right? Mm-hmm. And so you don't want to interrupt your story flow with some inappropriate puzzles, you know, yeah, difficulty at a certain point. So you're always, you know, balancing that. And generally, like, I think that the end of the game should be relatively easy to do. It's like you've kind of built people up, you know, you've kind of got them to the end of your third act, and they should be able to relatively quickly get through it based on all the knowledge that they've learned in the game so far. Mm-hmm. Because then a couple of things are going to happen. One is they're not going to get bored right at the end of your game, or stumped, and they're also going to feel really clever because they've learned a bunch of things, yeah, previously in the game. And it's like the end of Monkey Island 2, right, where you're building the voodoo doll of LeChuck, and you're building that doll based on all of these things that you have learned previously in the game. So, you know, the goal is that players will go, oh, I know how to build a voodoo doll. I remember the three things I need to do to build this doll from previous in the game. And so then you kind of work through the remainder of the third act by solving those puzzles relatively easily because of what you know.
Right. And you can sort of, I think I was maybe wrong in my framing of the question about like how hard it is to know sometimes. Because sometimes it's really easy to know, because for them to even reach that point, they need to know those things.
Right.
Right.
As long as they were paying attention. Yes.
Right. Which you can't control for.
Yeah. Well, that's true.
Well, let's talk about endings then.
Yeah.
Because like because there's definitely players who will play a game because they like the user story. They like the eureka they're solving. That's the opposite of the player who's just using the guide for the story, right? Mm. But when you reach the end and you have that success and you feel clever, is that the most important thing to you, delivering to a player, that feeling of success? Or at that point, they've reached the end of the story, and that's the thing you want them to walk away with the most? Like, what matters more to you?
I don't know that one matters more than the other. I think they're all very much intertwined, right? You want players to come out of the game with an experience, right? Mm-hmm. To feel like, yes, you know, I did it, or we did it, or that was a great story. You want them to come out with that feeling. And I think that feeling is a combination of the story concluding in a narrative way, but also the actions that they took to conclude the story are very satisfying to them. That's kind of the best combination of those two things.
Yeah. Without one, the other is not as interesting, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely true.
So that brings an interesting challenge, which is, are there certain types of messages or themes or plots or just generally just story where telling them with the language of puzzles is not as effective or particularly effective? Oh. Does it constrain the types of things the types of stories you can tell?
A little bit. You have to be careful because You know, in a traditional narrative, right? If the lead character is the hero of the thing, it's like, you know, Luke Skywalker going down the Death Star trench, and he's going to be the hero of doing that. Mm-hmm. You don't want to put the player in a position where they're heading down the trench and they have no idea how to shoot photons or lasers right. or bots.
Yeah.
Right. Because that's just frustrating for them.
Yeah.
And so you want to marry those two things together, that as the player is going down the trench, they also have all the knowledge to be able to complete their task as yeah. well. So you are having to make sure those things kind of go together, because a hero that defeats in a game anyway, a hero that, you know, defeats a nemesis, and the player wasn't really involved in it, right? They were just pushing the A button to continue or whatever, doesn't feel good. Neither does a player that is banging their head against this thing because they don't have the knowledge to do that.
Sure.
But although certain games, that's okay, right? If you're playing an intense action fighting game, beating your head against a final boss, maybe that is okay.
Yeah.
But I think that's not really you know, what we're talking about here with narrative games.
Right. Mm-hmm. I definitely found that interesting. So it sounds like, I mean, I guess generally speaking, most narratives that like have random things come up from left field are unsatisfying. But sometimes, like, that twist or change of pace with respect to a narrative can really be impactful and memorable. And I'm curious if having an ending or like a partway twist is still possible in a game like this, in an adventure game like this.
I think it is. I mean, just like a movie that does a big twist at the end, if it seems unfair, right, it's just a random twist.
Yeah.
It makes no sense. That's a bad thing. But if there's a big twist at the end and you as the audience go, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
I see. Because of these other things, I think it's the same thing with the game. If there's a big twist at the end, but you've given the player all the tools, maybe they don't immediately recognize they have the tools because of the twist. But if they understand they have all the tools post-twist, then it can feel satisfying.
Sure. Maybe even doubly so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You still have to put in the work to set that kind of stuff up if you want to, like, subvert expectations in that way.
Right, you can do a twist, this character isn't who you thought they were, mm-hmm. or you weren't going where you thought you were, but you maybe can't do twist, now it's a beat 'em up.
Yeah. Games have tried and failed.
Yeah. I mean, maybe you can, but the type of game, the type of prep you'd need to do for the player along the way without them catching on would be Herculean, I suppose.
Yeah, I would.
You know,
that's true.
And maybe self-defeating.
Yeah, I don't think you want to do a genre twist.
Right.
You know, right at the end.
Yeah. Well, I mean, actually, that's kind of true. Every now and then you'll hear about a movie that, like, turns out this was science fiction all along.
Yeah.
And even though that's very clever, people do tend to not like those movies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right? Well, because you go in with a certain expectation. Actually, that's a very good question, too. It's like you go in with a certain expectation for what kind of experience you're about to have. And then the story twists, changes on itself, maybe because you were given wrong information is what to expect for this thing, but also maybe because the game was giving you that wrong information.
Right.
And
either
sometimes
on purpose or
yeah, on purpose or just due to random various things. So I think that like setting players' expectations for what kind of a story that the game is going to provide for you is important, but it's I guess I'm curious about like that experience too, because like you also have to set people up to like be prepared to solve puzzles. Like, I'm imagining there's plenty of folks who started playing Monkey Island because they thought they heard it was a very funny game. And then they play it and they're like, oh, I gotta, like, think. And they weren't expecting
I was told there'd be jokes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think expectations are really important, right? You don't want to make people think they're playing one game and they're actually playing another game, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe they're just going to get a Steam refund at that point.
Yeah, right.
So you have to be careful that that you are setting that up. And some of that's marketing. You know, some mm-hmm. of that is making sure that you are advertising this game as an adventure game, so the people playing it understand that it's an adventure game. It's not a fighting game or vice versa.
Right.
So I think marketing plays a role in that. But also, you know, game design-wise, just that you're setting people up with the right tools to finish the game.
Yeah, I've definitely played games where within the first hour, I'm like, oh, this isn't what I thought.
Right.
But it's within the first hour.
Yeah.
And then the game does its job.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So if the marketing aligns with that, so much the better. But it is, like you say, it's a little bit due to that. Right. Mm-hmm. So I guess speaking of expectations and jokes, mm-hmm. One of the things that I think people love in this genre and in your games in particular is irony and meta humor. And I mean, puns and stuff like just and the things that are sort of that let the player play along in a way that is, if not perpendicular, just a little askew from the actual story that's being told. And part of that is playing with expectations. So, I mean, is that just style or is that something that informs design? Is it something you could ever really let go of if the design is right? Or is it something that like you leaning into improves everything else that's involved?
I think humor in adventure games is very fundamental. Mm-hmm. I think adventure games, you are asking the player to do a lot of stupid, ridiculous things.
Sure.
And if you try to treat that totally seriously, I think you kind of, it all falls apart at some point. It's like, well, why can I not just go to the store and buy a pencil? Why do I have to go find a pencil, you know, hidden in some guy's apartment? Why? You know?
Yeah.
I think if the game is funny and there's a lot of humor and you can get away with that kind of stuff, right? There's that suspension of disbelief, right? And the humor kind of allows you to really expand that suspension of disbelief. So personally, I think that adventure games need to be funny to kind of mask the absurdity that we're asking players to do.
Right, right. Do you think, because that sounds like a recommendation for, like, if someone wanted today to make an adventure game.
Yeah.
But do you think theoretically it's possible to make an adventure game that's not funny? Or fundamentally, do you think humor is so core to it that it's no longer an adventure game if it's not funny?
I don't think that the game is no longer an adventure game. I think that it's definitely one of those, you know, experiences taught me they must be funny, but people will come across and make one that isn't, and I go, oh, yeah, okay, I understand that.
Right, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
You know, like Firewatch, for example, right? Sure. I mean, at its core, Firewatch is an adventure game, mm-hmm. yeah. and it's a very serious game,
right?
Mm-hmm. But I think they did a really good job of not putting you in situations where you're doing ridiculous things.
Yeah.
Right.
They kept everything serious to match the story. You know, I think the puzzles probably aren't that challenging in that game because of that,
sure.
which I think for a lot of people is totally fine, right? Mm-hmm. They're playing Firewatch for kind of a different type of experience than hardcore, you know, bang your head against the screen adventure game. Mm. So I think them having much simpler puzzles that are a little more realistic that exist in a more serious story is well, I mean, it was fine, right? It's not probably fine. It was fine.
Yeah.
With the game. I don't know that I could do it though.
Right.
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 I think humor is just kind of embedded in everything I do. If I start to write a serious paragraph, it's funny by the end.
Yeah, there's a little, I think in games, a lot of people will have a sense of like that they can do anything. And they don't think of them, they think of themselves as craftspeople more than they think of themselves as artists. Mm. And so sometimes it is important to be like, this is what I am interested in.
Yeah.
And so it's not necessarily what will work for everybody, but it's what I'm going to do. So it's good to hear you say that like, that's just how you write and how you work.
I don't know. I would take on a job of designing a serious story.
Sure.
I don't think that's what I'm good at. I think there are other people who are good at that. It's not what I'm good at.
Yeah. Sure. Well, in the same vein, you were talking about it's still the world informs the story and the puzzles that you're telling. Firewatch's world informed the kinds of puzzles that they were able to provide to the player, due to the fact that they wanted it to feel grounded and realistic, and serious. In Monkey Island, that world is not serious, and so like you can do different things.
Just understatement of the century.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it doesn't necessarily preclude the ability to have serious moments.
Oh yeah.
Or if the player walk away with a serious notion.
Absolutely.
I mean, the cave is a good example of one where like you've found a way to still, you know, bring something to it on that dimension. We're hearing you now. It sounds like that it's something you wouldn't be interested in, but clearly you're capable, I think. So if you want to make it funny, you're a humorist. Mm. And so you find yourself on the opposite end. It's really serious. Then it can't be, the puzzles can't be that challenging. You can't make players do absurd things. But if you commit them to the absurdity of the adventure genre, then do you feel like less motivated to have themes of loss and relationships and the stuff of like art house cinema, right? That like people can either scoff at or aspire to, right? When it's really all that is just a thing. Do you find that is something that is just too difficult to weave in on the regular, or is it find something you just can sort of take a peek at? Am I making any sense? I'm getting really convoluted with this question.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. And I think if you look at all the stories that I've done, you know, maybe with the exception of Maniac Mansion, right, there's a serious element to it. Like the story and the stakes can be very serious, right? Yeah. And one of my favorite examples in the whole world is Ghostbusters, right? Because at its core, that is a serious story, right?
Sure.
But it's just funny how they told it, how they let the characters experience that serious story. Mm. And so I look at games the same way. I mean, Monkey Island is a very serious story, right? Mm. LeChuck is a horrible person. And he's, you know, terror on the high seas and all that stuff. So at its core, it is a serious story. And, you know, the cave, at its core, it is a serious story. But kind of how you interact with that story and experience that story can be in a humorous way, like Ghostbusters was.
Yeah. That's a brilliant connection. There's a great story about, like, a deleted scene in Ghostbusters where Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray play, like, homeless people, and it was, like, a sketch. Because that movie is basically a National Lampoon movie, yeah. And it kind of got away with being the classic that it is.
Mm-hmm.
But like, and they ended up cutting a lot of stuff that ended up, they didn't know it when they were making it because they were making a National Lampoon movie.
Yeah.
But then they ended up with what you're describing, that perfect synthesis of like a high stakes big mm-hmm. story that just happens to be, you know, screamingly funny.
Yeah.
And so, but sometimes you don't know that until you're making it. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, any game I've started in, I haven't really fully understood what the ending is. Right? Mm-hmm. It kind of, as you're developing the game, you're kind of injecting the humor. If you look at like the early design documents I wrote on Monkey Island, they read as very, very serious things.
Yeah.
There was no humor in them whatsoever. But as you know, as we started making that game, you know, of course, all this, you know, humor started to work its way, you know, into everything. It could have been a serious game, right? It could have been like Sid Meier's Pirates, right? It could have been that game. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that was me, you know, nor was it anyone else who was on the team. We just weren't those people. So we just did funny stuff.
Yeah.
But at its core, it still was serious.
I was trying to formulate a really thoughtful question about like a theme that's come up a couple of times around is like kind of having players sit in discomfort, but like not phrased exactly that way, but like that's kind of a, and I wanted to be like, is there a certain puzzle that you remember making that was intentionally supposed to make the player feel bad? Like,
Well, I mean, there's certainly stuff in Monkey Island. You know, Guybrush is kind of a clueless buffoon, right? He does horrible things to people,
mm-hmm.
Not because he's a horrible person, but just because he is single-mindedly focused on what he wants to do
right.
and not aware of the destruction that he's causing people around him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, so like in Return to Monkey Island, when he carves up this giant, you know, tree that's respected on the whole island, and he gets a little broom handle out of it, he thinks that is okay. Because he needed a broom handle. And the fact that he destroyed this tree and all the wildlife around it, he just doesn't see that.
Yeah.
So there are definitely things like that, you know, with Guybrush. You know, the cave is really about people doing horrible things, right? And paying the price for that. And so there are a lot of things you do in the cave. You're like, oh, man, I feel really bad for setting this amusement park on fire. But... it's kind of what you needed to do. So I hope people felt bad about that. I hope nobody set fire to the amusement park and were good about that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the thing about all video games is you tend to project yourself into the character.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But then there are times when the character is the character and you are the player.
Right.
And those points give you the opportunity to reflect on that. And so it's not really the designer's job to decide how much they enjoyed burning down the amusement park, but the question is posed, right?
The question is posed. Yeah, I like that. That's good. You can't control what kind of people play your games.
Yeah. Ron, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, no, I had a lot of fun. It was great talking to everybody. Thanks a lot.
That's our show. You can find Ron online on his website, grumpygamer.com, and on Mastodon. We'll put the link for that in the show notes. For that and additional show notes, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Threads at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and priorities. Reply there or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be looking at creative direction and time management. Beth, that's your topic.
Ooh.
I can't wait. But that's it for this week. So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
I mean, that's a pretty good place to end it, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Unless we missed anything. Beth, Steven, Ron, is there anything we missed?
No, I don't think so.
All right.
You did a good job.
Thank you.